When Russia invaded Ukraine in February, it was only a matter of time before Ukrainians fleeing their country tried to enter the United States, seeking asylum.
At first, it was just a couple of Ukrainian nationals coming in and presenting themselves at the border like anybody else does, right? In Tijuana is a migrant town, so we have this history of people from all over the world coming and presenting themselves at the border, and 9 times out of 10, they get turned away.
Reporter Gustavo Solis covers the border for KPBS in San Diego.
I remember the first family that kind of caught the national attention was a mother with 3 young children.
In Tijuana, one Ukrainian family also waiting to get to the U.S.
I probably don't have any other place to go.
Sofia is a mom of 3 kids who are 6, 12, and 14 years old.
And just by accident, an immigration lawyer saw them crying after they had been denied entry to the U.S. on the side at the port of entry in Mexico. And that lawyer represented them pro bono, fought for them, was able to get a humanitarian parole for them. And that was just the first case. Since then, the situation evolved and it's been a lot more organized, right? It wasn't just one or two families. It was like busloads and trainloads of families, and they got in line orderly. They were camping out by the port of entry for a couple of days. And CBP kind of changed their tactics. Instead of just shutting them out completely, they started allowing the Ukrainian nationals who show their passport to come in. At the peak of it, there were over 1,000 Ukrainian nationals, enough to fill a shelter in Tijuana, but it was very much streamlined. They would get picked up at the airport. Volunteers would be ready to... There was even a guy playing music for them, like a welcome party in Tijuana, which I hadn't seen before for migrants. But the city set up a shelter for them where they could eat, they could sleep, and within a day, CBP would process them and they would be on their way to the U.S.
As you might imagine, that streamlined process isn't the same for everyone. Depending on your country of origin, entering the U.S. at the San Ysidro crossing between Tijuana and San Diego can be quite a bit more complicated, or even impossible. Add on to that a little-used public health order from the 1940s called Title 42, which President Trump activated in the early months of the COVID pandemic in order to keep asylum seekers out. Gustavo Solis says it's a system that was already a patchwork, but now it's become even more opaque and, for the most part, less welcoming.
I think of it as like pre-Trump and post-Trump, and also pre-pandemic and post-pandemic, right? Before Trump, you would present yourself at the border. Even though you didn't have a passport, you would express fear, right? You would say, I want to claim asylum because I'm being persecuted back home for political reasons. Or more common was people from Central America who would say, look, the gang kidnapped my child, burned my home. If I go back, they said they're going to kill me. I can show you on my phone the death threats I have. Please let me go in and claim asylum. They would pass what was known as a credible fear interview and have a shot at it, right? Because just because you get into the U.S. doesn't mean you get asylum automatically. You just begin the lengthy legal process, which, statistically speaking, most of them would fail anyway. When Trump came in, that's when we started seeing these limits on asylum access. The first one was remain in Mexico, which was essentially you pass that credible fear interview, you get into the asylum process, but you're forced to live in Mexico while that case is adjudicated, oftentimes more than a year. Problem with that is that border cities in Mexico are dangerous, right? And nonprofit groups that were documenting these cases counted thousands of instances of people who our federal government sent back to Mexico, people who by definition are the most vulnerable in the world, right? They're asylum seekers. And they became victims of crime. They were victims of robberies, beatings, assaults, rapes, even kidnappings in some cases. Access to lawyers was another big thing, right? The entire asylum process is built on the assumption that the applicant is in the U.S. If you put the applicant in Mexico, it's very difficult for a lawyer who already has a lot of cases, who's doing a lot of these cases pro bono, to take a day out to do intake and talk to clients in Mexico and then come back. That means that's all they're doing that day. So logistically, it's just very challenging for them. So remain in Mexico was the first big kind of stop to asylum. At one point, people enrolled in the program, the grant rate was less than 1%. It was like 0.6% actually got asylum who were in that case. Then fast forward to the pandemic, and that's where we saw the other bigger restriction, which is Title 42. Title 42 just lets Border Patrol agents turn people away without due process, like, all the time, right? So at least in Remain in Mexico, you at least start your asylum case. With Title 42, it just shuts down the door completely for a lot of people. Just, sorry, you can't because of the pandemic. You know, better luck next time.
Now, people who are listening to you explain this may note that you said pre and post Trump and didn't make any distinction for a change under the new administration. Are the Trump era policies largely unchanged since the Biden administration and the Biden Homeland Security team came into power?
They are largely unchanged at this point right now. And that's partly because the Biden administration hasn't wanted to change some of these policies. With Title 42, hasn't really done anything. They announced that they're going to close it in May. Whether that happens or not is up to debate. But we're 2 years into the presidency already, and he kept it open despite criticisms. With Remain in Mexico, it's a little bit different. The Biden administration did end the policy almost as soon as he started office, but he got sued in federal court. I think it was out of Texas, that lawsuit, and a judge forced to bring it back. That's now before the Supreme Court. So then today, just independent of who got rid of it and who was forced to bring back, from the migrants' perspective, being at the border today is very similar to what it was like to be in the border when Trump was in office. And I should say, with Title 42, even though the Biden administration announced that it would be terminated, there's already a federal lawsuit, and the judges have indicated that they're going to sort of take a page out of the Remain in Mexico playbook and try to keep it in place through that lawsuit.
Are there a different set of rules prevailing for Ukrainian asylum seekers because the United States has announced that it's going to allow 100,000 citizens fleeing Ukraine to come into the United States?
At first, I wouldn't say it was a different set of rules. I would just say it was a different set of treatment for the Ukrainian nationals. And you saw it along the border, right? Title 42 has been around for almost 2 years now in Tijuana. I've been covering it a lot of the time. And it was really striking to see that when the Ukrainian nationals came in after a couple weeks, they were basically exempt from Title 42, which, like, legally, and if it's written in the health order, could happen to any nationality, right? Title 42 gives Border Patrol agents the authority to turn away asylum seekers without due process, but it also gives them the discretion to grant exemptions on a case-by-case basis. When the Ukrainians came, they were getting exemptions. Essentially, all they had to do was show their passport. At the same time, I did stories about a Haitian family whose child had a chronic and debilitating skin condition. Half her body was covered in these scars. She couldn't get the medical help that she wanted in Tijuana, so she asked for that same exemption that she was entitled to, a case-by-case exemption on medical grounds. It was denied. So what happened? They had a lawyer. They had a team of two lawyers, actually, nonprofits, who got doctors, two different doctors in the U.S. to do telehealth, to document that this is a serious condition, and write letters to CBP. They had to go to beyond CBP to DHS, essentially like lobby for them to get that same exemption. So what that illustrates is that the same exemptions that Ukrainians were getting just by showing their passport, folks from other nationalities had to jump through tougher loops and barriers to get that same exemption. So it wasn't so much a different set of rules, it was a different set of guidelines, basically, for Ukrainians. Now it's a little bit different. With the Biden administration, they announced this program where Ukrainian nationals can apply from abroad online and kind of get vetted at their home country and then fly directly to the U.S. instead of having to go through the border. So Uniting for Ukraine, that same program also allows U.S. nationals to apply as sponsors. So you and I could go on the DHS website and apply as sponsors and host Ukrainian war refugees. One of the hiccups of that program that I saw covering the border in Tijuana was that on the same day that program was announced, coming in through the border was shut down. So there were people who were on a plane when that program was announced, came to Tijuana, and then were told, oh, sorry, you should have been here yesterday. Those people, at least in Mexico and in Tijuana, they just went back to Mexico City, where a nonprofit in Mexico City set up a shelter for Ukrainians where the Ukrainians can live in Mexico City and apply for that U.S. program while they're there instead of being in border towns and trying to figure out from here.
Have there been complaints? Has there been pushback among immigrant advocates who find the difference between someone trying to come in from Haiti or West Africa, fleeing gang violence in Honduras, or someone who walked or took a bus all the way from the coffee region of Guatemala, and say, look, this is not fair, this is not right, or find an even more offensive explanation rooted in race and ethnicity?
I think you were being a little diplomatic, but the advocates will call it out and say it's racist, right? Even if it's not racist by design, the application is itself racist. And at the border, it's impossible to not see the optics of white European asylum seekers getting easier access than Black Haitian migrants, brown Central American migrants who have been waiting here for over a year already. And it's very difficult to explain the difference to the migrants because there is no legitimate explanation, right? They would ask the lawyers, they would even ask me, like, well, what do I have to do to get that same treatment, right? Why them? Why not me? I've been here since last year and I'm living in a shelter and they're getting a fast track. Like, I don't know how you explain that to somebody other than it's not fair and it sucks and I'm sorry. I should be clear, there was kind of outrage and frustration, but from the migrants' perspective, there wasn't a lot of animosity towards the Ukrainian nationals, right? They recognized it's more of a systemic issue. And in some cases, there was a lot of solidarity. I remember early on when the Ukrainians were getting through, the Ukrainians were actually lobbying for Mexican and Cuban asylum seekers, saying, no, it's not our turn. They've been here longer. Let them through. It was really beautiful, but also heartbreaking to see. And at the end of the day, what the advocates were advocating for, the problem wasn't that the Ukrainians were getting through. The problem was that not everybody else was getting that same treatment, right? It comes down to an equity issue at the end of the day.
It is fascinating to me that if you look at a map, the idea that Tijuana would become a port of entry for someone fleeing Russian shelling in Eastern Europe is just kind of odd. It makes sense for a Salvadoran to end up in Tijuana. It makes some kind of sense for a Cuban to end up there. But what kind of circuitous trips are Ukrainians ending up in Tijuana using?
Well, most of the people I talk to, they're here because they have friends or family in the U.S. So their destination is the U.S. Obviously, they can't fly directly to the U.S. because it's very difficult to get a visa from that part of the world to here. But it isn't very difficult to get one to Mexico. And that's kind of how it worked out, right? People would flee Ukraine. Early on in the war, I heard stories of people taking trains and buses, just packed like sardines in trains for hours, getting to the western part of Ukraine, and then taking a series of small planes or buses to places like Germany. From Germany, they'd fly either directly to Mexico City, sometimes Cancun, sometimes as far as Bogota, Colombia, and then make their way to Tijuana, which itself is kind of noteworthy because there's a class issue to this, right? The Ukrainian nationals have more money than the types of migrants we normally see in Tijuana, right? They can fly. Some of them could rent hotels. A couple of them pulled their resources together and bought used cars. Normally, the migrants in Tijuana are walking or riding on top of a train that's so dangerous it's been nicknamed La Bestia, where people die, and they sleep on the street. So that's also an interesting factor of this. But it comes down to the fact that you can get a visa in Mexico or you don't even really need one. You fly there and then you just cross the border. We see the similar type of migration from Chinese nationals as well here in Tijuana.
Now, you mentioned something that I think may end up being an important point of distinction. That is that there are waiting sponsors in the United States. There are waiting families in the United States. A lot of Ukrainians have relatives in North America, either Canada or the United States. Does that make it easier for them, not only on the receiving end, but once they are given passage and allowed into the country?
I think so, right? I mean, you have that built-in network of support, right? You have families ready to take you in. You have a room waiting for you. I talked to a woman in Orange County who basically just had the support of her community around her, not just her, right? She had gotten donations because her niece left with only a backpack. She left out of, she lived in Kyiv. Actually, this niece, she was from Crimea. She had to flee Crimea after the Russian invasion there, then went to Kyiv. And this is the second time she's fleeing Putin's aggression. She got to Tijuana, and her aunt just had this outpouring of support. She had food and clothes and a room and job leads. She was a graphic designer, so she was already kind of looking into how she could do that support, which I think is very telling of the immigrant experience, immigrant community, right? There's established hotspots, and obviously it helps if you have that foot in the ground already.
Is the family connection, in this case, key? Because otherwise, a lot of Ukrainians want to shelter in countries closer to their hometowns. They are anticipating someday an end to all this, and they want to go home, so they'd rather be in Bulgaria, Moldova, Poland. It makes more sense for them to be in those places if they do have a real intention of returning home.
Well, that's right, and I think that applies to all asylum seekers at the border, right? None of them want to be here. None of them want to be in Tijuana in shelters and kind of waiting to get in. And if they had a choice, their choice would be to live back home, right? That's where their family is from. That's where their life is from. But through circumstance, even a war in Ukraine or cartel violence or political dissension, there's a lot of Russians here who are also fleeing Putin. There's a lot of political turmoil in Central America, and the people who speak out against it end up over here. None of them want to be here. This is sort of their plan B, right? They're fleeing for their lives, and if they stay, they're afraid for their lives, so they're coming here. If they had a choice, yeah, they'd rather be closer to home. They'd rather wait it out and go back to where their life is.
You know, a lot of Americans are pretty unsympathetic toward refugees. They see it as immigration by other means. They're people who just want to be here, but they're willing to use the setbacks of the moment as a stealth way into the country. I think it's important that you're saying that a lot of these people would go home if conditions warranted it.
Well, definitely. And I think another important point to make is that it is 100% legal to come into this country without a passport, without a visa, and request asylum, right? Asylum is a legal way to get into the U.S. A lot of cases, the only legal way to do it. So there's this rhetoric around eliminating Title 42. And if we eliminate Title 42, there will be a wave of illegal immigration in this country. I don't see that happening because requesting asylum, again, is legal. There's the critique, right, that if you start the process and you come in, then you're just going to be here while you're waiting for it. That's not really their fault. It's not the migrants' fault that the immigration court is backlogged and there's 1.8 million cases that need to be resolved. That's really our federal government's fault in not addressing the problem beforehand. But I do think in the context of what's legal and illegal, we should always be aware that this is the legal way of doing it. And it goes back to agreements that we signed and made as a country going back to World War II.
Is the meter running? I mean, how many of those presumed, theoretical 100,000 slots have the Ukrainians used by now? How many of those people have actually gotten into the country at this point?
I honestly don't know. And that's been one of the criticisms of the Biden administration, is that they threw this number out there, but they didn't really say what it meant, right? Does 100,000 mean 100,000 refugees or 100,000 asylum seekers? Or first come, first serve? I'm honestly not sure, and a lot of people on the ground aren't sure either. That's kind of why you saw this rush of people from Ukraine trying to get in through the border, trying to get in as quickly as possible.
Can advocates for other national groups go to school on the Ukraine policy? Are there things that, if you're advocating for people fleeing violence against the Rohingya in Burma, if you're advocating for people who are fleeing social breakdown in parts of Central America, are there things to be learned about how the system is working in Uniting for Ukraine that might help?
I think in the context of Title 42, no, because Title 42 is so arbitrary. But maybe in the larger context, I think so. I don't know if this United for Ukraine program works out. It could be seen as a blueprint for other countries, maybe other countries that already have something like temporary protected status. But it is interesting that there are rolling out new programs, right? There's a recognition that the current asylum system isn't working the way it's supposed to, so we need these supplemental programs to streamline them. It's unfair that it's on a nationality basis and not a humanitarian basis. But who knows, that could be the start of something. I think if you're optimistic, you could kind of see this as a starting point of an evolution of making the asylum system more accessible after a couple of years of it going the other direction.
The Title 42 battle was interesting in part because it was rooted in the pandemic and is also rooted in American history. As different waves of people have come here over the past two centuries, there's often been an attempt to exclude people by hinting that they may be diseased when they get here. It's a very, very old American trope and was used frequently in the late 19th and early 20th century. When the pandemic wanes, hoping that it does someday, is Title 42 just going to look hopelessly outdated and very much a product of trying to use the panic over one thing to keep out people that you didn't want to let in anyway?
Well, I think the historians will decide that, right? But history does tend to repeat itself. And if you look at the rhetoric of the arguments in favor of keeping Title 42, none of them are on public health grounds. So Title 42 is this weird policy that from the beginning was painted to us, to the public, as a pandemic health order, right? It's issued by the CDC. But we found out later through reporting that the Trump administration went above the head of CDC doctors and kind of forced the agency to do this, not on public health grounds, but on immigration enforcement grounds. So now when you see these arguments for keeping it, they're all based on securing the border and not letting the wrong kind of people in. They're not based on the pandemic. And actually, a lot of the states that are suing the Biden administration to keep Title 42, they're states that have been actively fighting vaccine and mask mandates, right? So in any context, they're the states that are pushing back against the pandemic restrictions. But in this one, it's like this is the one pandemic restriction that they're on board. And it just happens to be the one that mostly keeps poor immigrants out of the country. So I think it's more out in the open now, right? It's kind of more blatant. It started as this pandemic era thing, and the conversation was about public health. But I think now we all know what it really has been about the whole time. So I think it makes it easier to recognize. It makes it easier to talk about. And unfortunately, it is a reminder of some of the darker periods in our country's history.
If there is a legitimate worry, if you come from a country that's had a rough time with the pandemic, is it easy to get screened? Is it easy to get vaccinated? Is it easy to get tested? Is that part of the system? If you show up at that great big frontier station between San Diego and Tijuana, can somebody check whether or not you are COVID positive?
I have gotten multiple rapid tests in San Ysidro, just like a few steps away from the border. You can cross the border and you see a booth right there. Actually, I've gotten them like while I'm working just on downtime, and they tell me in a couple minutes whether I'm positive or not. They are very available. Obviously, not as they weren't when the pandemic started, but we're at a point now when rapid testing and vaccines are readily available. And one thing that's worth noting about Title 42 that kind of tells you everything you need to know about that policy is that there are no exemptions for people who are vaccinated or who are tested and test negative for it, right? So you can be vaccinated and still be shut out from this pandemic era restriction.
Gustavo Solis of KPBS, great to talk to you.
Hey, thanks for having me. Really enjoyed the conversation.
You've been listening to World Affairs, produced in partnership with KQED, with funding from TPG, the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, and from listeners like you. If you'd like to support the program by becoming a member or making a donation of any size, please go to worldaffairs.org/donate. And we want to hear from you. What did you think about today's episode? Are there any other international stories you'd like us to cover? Please send an email or a voice memo to feedback@worldaffairs.org. Today's episode was produced by Andrew Stelzer and Matteo Schimpf, who also mixed and mastered the program, with additional engineering by Rob Spate. Research and fact-checking was done by Ryan Housel. She's our associate producer. Jim Bennett is our technical supervisor. Our executive producer is Joanne Jennings. Philip Yun is the CEO of World Affairs. The music you're hearing is from Blue Dot Sessions. I'm Ray Suarez. Thanks for joining us.